All right, this is March 1st, 1990, and I'm Bill Jones interviewing the Reverend Matt, is it Matthias or?
Matthias.
Matthias, all right, the Reverend Matthias Giger. And as part of the Heritage Commission Oral History Project. Matt, I like to start off with just giving you a chance to give us a brief overview of your career, your education, your job experience, which led you finally to arrive in Moorhead.
Okay. Well, I started out my life in southwestern Iowa in a little town named Minden, son of a couple of chicken hatchery owners, and attended the Congregational Church in Minden, which then became the United Church of Christ. Went through the normal public school classes from kindergarten through 12th grade, then went away to college at Central Missouri State College in Warrensburg, Missouri. I got a degree in sociology with a minor in psychology. Throughout my my formative years in Minden and throughout my college career, I always felt a gentle but irresistible pull or call to ministry. And after graduating from college, I attended United Theological Seminary in New Brighton, Minnesota, which is a United Church of Christ-related seminary. After seminary, I was called to Minnehaha United Church of Christ in Minneapolis, very near Minnehaha Falls Park.
Lovely area.
It is just beautiful. If there's one thing I miss that that area and the park system and the bike paths. We could travel from Minnehaha Falls on our bicycles all the way across South Minneapolis to Lake Harriet, Lake Calhoun, Lake of the Isles. And that was something I really miss.
Understandably.
In getting to Moorhead, I had no intention of looking for a position. But I think one of the things that we have in the United Church of Christ tradition is a strong sense of God calling ministers to congregations. And also, I think, churches being called to consider particular men and women as pastors. As a matter of fact, I tried everything I could to dodge the call, but our conference minister at the time, the Reverend Radale Laseth, took me aside one day, threw a half Nelson on me, and said, in essence, "How dare you frustrate the working of the Spirit? If this is meant to be, then you have to follow through on it. And if it's not meant to be, then you'll know." So I reluctantly began the whole process of the search, sending in my dossier to the search committee at First Congregational, doing a telephone interview and an on-site interview and a neutral pulpit preaching experience. And every step along the way, I thought, well, I've done all that I have to do. They won't consider me any further, until I was invited to an actual candidacy sermon. And out of that, received the call. And after signing the call papers, which is a part of the process in the United Church of Christ, that afternoon, I finally figured out that this was a legitimate call, because I read in the annual minutes of the annual meeting for the congregation that they had received a report by sort of a long-range planning committee, and they listed five or six areas that they wanted the church to be involved in the future. Everything from membership growth to church vitality, social concerns. And what struck me was that in the initial on-site interview, everything I had talked about as either being an interest or a concern for me was listed in this report. And it was at that point, after about 4 or 5 months of real agonizing, that it all made sense. Mm-hmm. And I really thought at that point, the call is legitimate. Mm-hmm. So that's what brought me to Moorhead in 1983.
So the Moorhead First Congregational United Church of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
Let's just talk a little bit about the church in general rather than this specific church. You obviously have been brought up within that tradition, the congregational tradition. And then during the course of your experience, did the amalgamation of the two denominations into the United Church of Christ occur mm-hmm. during your youth?
Yes. I grew up in Minden Congregational Church. But in 1957, the congregation at a special meeting voted to become part of the United Church of Christ. Mm-hmm. And so I was confirmed into the church through the United Church of Christ.
Mm-hmm. What particularly, now obviously you have a much broader perspective than you had when you were young. Mm-hmm. And yet you've stayed true to the church that you were brought up in. What particularly appeals to you as far as the congregational tradition?
I think part of the appeal comes in the sense that the individual believer must take responsibility for his or her belief and then how he or she expresses faith, and that there is a real sense of a personal relationship, a personal responsibility to God and to Christ, and that we cannot rely upon someone else to impose our belief structure. We must take personal responsibility and act personally on that. The next thing coming out of that is, I think, the whole notion that if each one of us is called to faith and called to express that faith, then when we join together as a congregation, as a church, as a denomination, we must be very sensitive to what God may be saying through a particular individual or group of individuals, that we must be respectful of that and attentive to that, and also challenge that if we hear God saying something different, and that out of that process then we begin to develop an understanding of what God's will really is in our lives, in our faith, and in our world. And also, I think a third area that develops out of the first two is the whole notion that we are not simply responsible Christians in the life of the church, but we must be responsible people of faith in the community. That our responsibility does not end at the door of the sanctuary, but really must be carried out into the world. And I think our tradition and the founding denominations, evangelical, Christian, Reformed, and Congregational, all have a strong sense of social commitment, social responsibility, of proclaiming the Word of God, not only through word, but in deed in the world. And I appreciate the fact that in our history in this country, we were the Pilgrims and the Puritans who struggled with what it meant to be the people of God in a new land. Mm-hmm. And the people who opposed things like slavery or established orphanages and retirement centers for retirement homes for the elderly, who established hospitals that took care of the poor in the community. who...
And lots of colleges.
And lots of colleges, you know, a strong sense of the colleges. Yeah, and you have personal,
right.
Personal acquaintance with those. So those sorts of things of saying the faith is not simply privatized or institutionalized, but it is a faith that must be taken into the community and must be used for the furtherment of God's will and for the strengthening of the community, not just the national community or the state community, but the world community.
Mm-hmm. Now, the United Church of Christ label came about in a response to a kind of a national dynamic operating to on behalf of ecumenical concerns, and the Congregationalists then combine with another denomination. Was there any, and that denomination was?
That was the Christian Church. Christian Church got its foundation in, or was formed in the early 1800s by disaffected Methodists and Presbyterians who appreciated the more congregational type of polity. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so they had a polity that was similar to the congregational polity in that the local church was the center of authority in mm-hmm. all of the dealings of the church.
Mm-hmm.
And churches might join together to accomplish things like set up a missionary society or establish a college or a seminary. But all authority rested with the local congregation. And in the 1920s then, the congregational and the Christian churches merged to form the congregational Christian churches. But then also we have the tradition of the German Lutheran and Swiss Reformed movements. And those came over to this country in the mid to late 1700s and 1800s. And those came out of mainland Europe, the German and Reformed, the German and Swiss areas. And so they formed in the 1930s a denomination called the Evangelical and Reformed
mm-hmm.
Church. And they had a different polity. Their polity was more what you might say formally hierarchical,
mm-hmm.
With a synod that would pass pronouncements that were implemented by the local church. But in the 1920s and 30s, after the Second World War, after the First World War, there was a great ecumenical movement in Europe and in the United States. And there was a real sense that we need to do away with the denominational identifications, because that was a fragmentation of the Church of Jesus Christ. And so out of that came the Consultation on Church and Union, COCU. And so during the 20s and 30s, there was a real effort towards ecumenicity.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the 40s and early 50s, the Congregational Christian Churches and the Evangelical and Reformed Church, even though they had different polities and different traditions in the Protestant Reformation, began talking about union themselves. And by 1957, all of the legal roadblocks were removed, and the churches moved towards organic union.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that process, they realized that if they were going to be true to their ecumenical foundation, that they had to give up their own names. On top of that, calling themselves the Evangelical Reformed Congregational Christian Churches were going to be a little cumbersome.
Mm-hmm.
I think someone said that you'd end up with the acronym IRC if you did that. So what they did was they said, let's talk about what we are trying to do, not what we are doing as a denomination, but but the philosophy that binds us together. And so they came up with the name the United Church of Christ. And at one point they even thought about changing it to the Uniting Church of Christ. That spoke to the philosophy of the whole ecumenical movement in the Christian tradition.
Mm-hmm. I've always felt that was not the most fortunate choice in that it confuses. There is a Church of Christ.
Mm-hmm. Which is quite different.
Quite different, yes. Mm-hmm. Comes from a quite different tradition. And that always requires a little explanation to someone mm-hmm. who has not been through this.
Yeah.
Let's talk about now about the particular church that you now serve. How would you describe its distinctives? What characteristics do you feel that are evident as you came from outside and began to discover this particular fellowship? What did you discover?
Okay. Let me start out by making a general observation on what I would see to be the psychology of the community of mm-hmm. Morehead, Fargo, and the surrounding
Good.
Environs. I came from Minneapolis. I went to seminary there. I was a minister there for seven and three quarters years. When I announced to my colleagues in Minneapolis that I was being called to a church in Morehead, their response was, "But that's the end of the earth."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A missionary outpost.
Yes, right? At one point I thought of myself as sort of a missionary among the Lutherans, you know. But when I got up here, I found that the general attitude was about the same. As one person said, no, this is not the end of the earth, but if you stand on a sugar beet, you can see it. Also, when I started to make the transition from Minneapolis to Morehead, I would spend maybe two or three days up here talking with staff and with church leaders and members of the congregation, and going back and completing my responsibilities in Morehead, or in Minneapolis. Whenever I was up here, the one thing that people would say when they learned I was moving from Minneapolis-St. Paul area was, "But we're really a good place when you get to know us." There was a real sense that they were apologizing for the fact that I was moving from this mecca of culture and art and literature and progressive thought to some backwater. It really struck me that the people up here were selling themselves short, that they really didn't understand what they had here, this too is an area that has the literature and the art and the culture, but it also embodies the basic positive qualities and attributes one would expect to find in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
The type of thing that Garrison Keillor is so prone to extol in his Prairie Home Companion monologues or his books. The type of thing that people on both coasts, inwardly long for. The kind of Protestant work ethic, value in one's responsibility to one's neighbors and one's community, the role that the church plays in the community, the fact that the individual can make a difference in the community, that they are not just a cipher or a number, that if an individual has an idea that is worth something in this community, they can work to see that idea or that vision fulfilled. And when I first got here, then the big thing going on was the building of the Heritage Jomkomst Center, and I think it was sort of symbolized in the legend of Robert Asp,
mm-hmm.
how one individual, in conjunction with others who shared his vision, could accomplish something. So I think that's something that that I saw in the psychology of the community, that it didn't, and I still don't think does, understand what its real strengths are, what its real power is, that it continues to apologize to others when it doesn't need to.
Mm-hmm.
And so taking that one step further and looking at the at the church at First Congregational UCC, I saw some of that going on too. Basically, I was impressed with the fact that we had and have a congregation filled with very, very intelligent, competent people. And I'm not talking just about, quote, book learning or formal education, but men and women who are intelligent and wise, and are really one of the best natural resources that this congregation has, or that the United Church of Christ has. So there's really a sense from the very beginning that the church was filled with very good people. And I'm not saying that because you're my moderator. So I've said that all along. But one of the problems was that that I don't think they really realized their potential. And what I attempted to do the first couple years, and I got into a little trouble for it, was to force them to begin to take responsibility for their own God-given abilities. And more than once I had people coming in saying, well, you know, in our church, the lay people do things. You know, you're not supposed to do this stuff. And whenever they would come in, then I would try to say, okay, then let's do it. And I think finally, I really felt a turnaround several years ago when when my mother-in-law died in Arkansas, and we had to go down for the memorial service, the whole family, and it was at the time of the annual congregational meeting, which is sort of the mecca for the congregational polity. And this is where the church acts to make decisions. And when I told people, well, I won't be at the annual meeting, universally the response first was, oh, but you'll miss the meeting. And secondly, after they thought for just a moment, the universal comeback was, but that's all right, you're only the minister. The congregational meeting is for the congregation.
Mm-hmm.
And really a sense that, hey, we are the church.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so I think that the my initial impression was a valid one, that we have a congregation filled with competent, intelligent, wise people that can take responsibility for the running and the work and the ministry of the church, and that my role is to encourage them to do so, or in some cases, give them permission to do what God is calling them to do. The problem, though, the real frustration, though, is that because the people are so committed, they're not only committed to the life of the church, but they're also committed to the life of the community. And they, by and large, they see that their responsibility as leaders is not simply to the church, but also is in the community. And so many of our people are on various boards and agencies and commissions in the Fargo-Moorhead area. So their time is taken up with witnessing their faith through their actions as they seek to be responsible citizens, which means that we in the church have to vie for their time and talents.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that struck me from the very beginning was, and I think it's symbolized in the architecture of the church building.
Which is an older church, mm-hmm. a decision was made to stay with that mm-hmm. older structure yeah. in downtown Moorhead, rather than to move out, as many of the other congregations have.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, on the corner of 4th Avenue and 8th Street South since 1900, when the old part of the structure was built, and then in the 1950s, when there was really a temptation to get rid of the old buildings, to move out to where the new housing developments were and build new churches, the church made a conscious decision to stay where it was, to expand its facilities, to meet the influx of members that churches across the country were experiencing in the 50s. And also to maintain a certain quality or integrity of the building that I think spoke to its to the congregation's understanding of who it was. The outside of the building is interesting. Someone said it's the architectural style is squat Romanesque, which is not very attractive in terms of the sound of it, but a very solid building with simple line. And when you walk into the sanctuary, you find you're in basically a square sanctuary with a rather large chancel at one end. But the furnishings are very simple. Lovely stained glass windows that emit a nice, warm, lovely light. Plain walls with some strikingly simple but distinctive banners. The woodwork is all dark. The pews are curved, so there's more of a sense of community. And because of the size of the sanctuary, it's very intimate. You cannot really sit at the back of the church and feel that you are at a distance from the center of worship. And because of the curvedness of the pews, there's a real sense that you are focused in on both the worship center, but also you can see one another. You're not regimented with rank of straight pews, but there's a sense that, and all you see is the back of someone else's head.
Yeah.
But in the sanctuary, there's a real sense of being able to see one another in the pews, and it makes for a very intimate type of setting. And I think that reflects then on the psychology of the congregation and its people. The solidness, established, we are here to stay in the community, and the simplicity of the sanctuary, again, speaks to the Reformation tradition, especially in the Calvinist Puritan tradition. And that sense of intimacy, that we are here worshiping together as a family of faith. I think those reflect on the values of the congregation mm-hmm. as it seeks to be faithful to God in this community.
The congregation, as it relates to the overall spectrum of worshiping fellowships in the community, how does it relate there? Clearly, this is dominated by Lutherans with a strong second Roman Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
Where would you put the First Congregational in that whole spectrum?
On the whole, I would see First Congregational being one of the few representatives of the Free Church tradition in Moorhead. Of the mainline free church traditions. I think that it has an open and accepting stance towards people who are motivated by God's spirit to worship with us. Let's take first the worship service itself. Because we come out of the Free Church tradition, we do not have a prescribed liturgy. The liturgy is an outgrowth of the understanding that the pastor has of worship, in conjunction with the understanding that the congregation has of what is appropriate to worship. So what we do is we are true to the Reformation tradition of worship, but feel that it is best expressed on a congregational level. And what I try to do then is to incorporate the long tradition of the church with more contemporary need and more contemporary voices, so that we try to balance off the 2,000, 3,000 year heritage we have of worship with the contemporary expression of worship, so that worship is not simply an historic document, but is a living, lively, vital part of one's Christian expression. Mm-hmm. And because of that, we end up being seen as, I think, and we perceive ourselves as being on a more liberal end, a left-wing end of the Protestant Christian tradition. Beyond that, I think that there is an openness and acceptance of all peoples and all beliefs as much as we can. My experience at this church and in my former church was that it didn't matter theologically where a person stood. What mattered was that they felt that God had called them to worship in the congregation and to be a member of the congregation. Mm-hmm. And there tends to be a real respectful attitude towards people who have differing theological perceptions. In my former church in Minneapolis, there was a case of an elderly woman who had a very literal understanding of the Bible, who usually sat next to a younger man who had a very liberal understanding of the Bible and theology. And it was apparent that they both loved and appreciated one another and enjoyed the fact that they were there together worshiping God in their own way. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we have here at First Church as well, that real sense of your particular creed or doctrine is not as important as the fact that you have come here to share in this worship experience, to share in this family of faith. And that you sharing your perspective and me sharing my perspective will help us both better understand more completely what God is really trying to say. Also, there's a sense that there's the idea that we are a non-creedal church. That is, we do not require the adherence to a particular creed, to a particular statement of belief that's prescribed for us, that we accept people where God has brought them in their faith journey, and we recognize that the individual believer is on a pilgrimage through life that is not completed until we reach the ultimate goal, the ultimate reality in God's holy realm. And so I think that we end up on the left hand side of the Protestant Reformation, mm-hmm. in that respect.
The church has traditionally, of course, been very attractive to members to teachers, mm-hmm. educators, at one time, I believe every president of Morehead State, for example, was a member until President Neumeyer,
who
was a Jew. And then Roland Dill continued to break the tradition, mm-hmm. although he was a member of a congregational church in Minneapolis.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. And President Dill told me one time that basically his wife had come from this community originally.
Yes.
And she had been a Presbyterian. And so since he felt it was only fair that if she had followed him to his church of preference and other places, when they got back home to her home, that it was only fair for him to go there.
Sure.
I think this probably points out the strong commitment that the United Church of Christ has had to education.
Mm-hmm.
And my reading is that prior to World War II, most of the teachers who went into to colleges and were administrators and professors came out of the congregational affiliated schools, because the Congregationalists from the time of the founding of Harvard and Yale have always had a strong commitment to education. The sense that the only way in which you can really understand the will of God is if you are educated and can make up your own mind.
Yeah, the life of the mind is not suspect. It is certainly one
mm-hmm.
way of...
Mm-hmm.
The church, I find it interesting the your description of the theological, because it would be difficult thus to say that the congregation shares an allegiance to a particular theology. I mean, at least there's room for considerable variety within this kind of overall rubric. As you look at theological movements of today, what is happening? I mean, as far as theology is concerned, you have, as far as manifestations within this community, which of course is our major concern mm-hmm. in this commission, the really far left, which is liberation theology, which is usually has a Marxist tinge, is not represented, I mm-hmm. would guess. On the other hand, the far right, which would it be the charismatic churches, the more fundamentalistic churches? They are very well represented, mm-hmm. and so the whole spectrum. But are there any central tendencies as far as theology of today, and how does this community? How is this community affected by them?
Mm-hmm. I think making another general observation, one of the things that I've seen here in the Red River Valley, in the Moorhead-Fargo community, is that the people tend to take church and the religious community very seriously. They, to the point that they make fun of it in a loving way.
It's a little bit like being Norwegian.
Yeah.
You can have Norwegian jokes, but they're done in respect and love.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Or they're not done at all.
That's right.
When I was first here during that first year, there was a teacher strike in the public school. And one of the things that I found surprising coming from Minneapolis, St. Paul, and having lived in other locations, was that people came up to me and said, what are the ministers doing to help in this situation? You know, not, are you taking sides as an individual?
Mm-hmm.
But rather, what is the religious community? What are our churches and our pastors doing to help resolve the situation? They didn't care where we came down. They saw us as being one of the primary sources for conflict resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that refreshing because I hadn't seen that anywhere else, that the churches do continue to play a central part in the life of the community and its people. I would never, if there were a teacher strike in Minneapolis, St. Paul, or New York, or Chicago, or Oakland, or Oklahoma City, or Walla Walla, I would not expect to see that kind of expectation
mm-hmm.
on the part of the religious community. So I think that here we continue to adhere to the traditions of the Midwest, in that we have a respect for the religious community. One of the problems I see here in this community, though, and more so across the nation, is the fact that we are moving more and more towards, and I don't want to use the term secularize because that's gotten too much play and would cloud the issue. But we are moving more and more towards a laissez-faire understanding of religious, almost an entrepreneurial concept of the church, whereas the church is there to meet my needs, and it should be there whenever I require it. But for the rest of the time, I can go off and do my own thing. And when the demands of the church come into conflict with the demands of my other commitments, then I will more often than not opt for those other commitments and responsibilities. And I think what I see in the more right-wing response mm-hmm. is a reaction to that, saying, and I agree with this part, that the church is should be at the center of one's life, because it is here that probably some of the best values are transmitted for respect, for living, for making sense out of an otherwise chaotic world. The church is the place where we tend not to relativize everything and talk about political expediency or economic reality, but we attempt to talk about responsibility to one's creator, responsibility to creation, responsibility to one's neighbor, and also responsibility to oneself. So in our community, I think we still see that happening, and that the right wing of the spectrum of the Christian church is saying we need to get back to basics, back to fundamentals. And it is a reaction to the irresistible pull of society to a more privatized understanding of who we are. And we lose contact, we lose contact with reality.
Mm-hmm.
But while that's going on, and more of a pull towards that conservative fundamentals of faith, I don't want to say fundamentalist, but fundamentals of faith, there's also in the mainline church another set of dynamics at work that are pulling us in another way, and that is more and more a sensitivity to the fact that I am an individual who, as a person of faith, as a child of God, live in community with other people who are also children of God. And that my responsibility is not simply for their religious well-being, but for their general well-being as well. And we are interrelated and interconnected, and the health of others affects my health as an individual, not bodily health, but spiritual health.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see in the mainline churches a real struggle with how can we be faithful to the needs of our brothers and sisters in the community, in the nation, and throughout the world, and yet also maintain the fundamentals of our faith, so that we can transmit the faith and transmit those values that are, to use a biblical term, perfect, that is, mature, grown up. Jesus talks about you must be perfect like your Father in heaven is perfect, meaning you must be as grown up and as mature in your life as God is grown up and mature. And so we're struggling with that. And it's unfortunately, I see that those who are on the right hand side of the spectrum and those that are on the left hand side of the spectrum perceive themselves in a battle. And that the ones on the right hand side of the spectrum are saying to the ones on the left hand side, you are forsaking the fundamentals of the faith for accommodation in the world. And the ones on the left-hand side are saying to those on the right, no, you are narrowly interpreting and defining what the fundamentals are, and you are losing sight of the universality of God's love and grace. And so we end up being at odds with one another, unfortunately. And I think that that maybe what we need to do is to look a little closer at the Christian expression that has gone on for the last 40 years in the quote evil empire unquote in those countries of Eastern Europe, of Russia, and of the People's Republic of China, where theological differences and creedal differences were not as important as the ability to express one's faith.
Now, one of the distinctive things in this community, of course, has been the ability of a fairly large number of congregations to work together. Churches United for the Homeless is one good example, and the Dorothy Day House is an early manifestation of that concern. That was had primarily, I think, a Roman Catholic origin.
That comes out of the Roman Catholic workers' movement.
But the Churches United, clearly a much broader base. Is the whole spectrum of theological spectrum represented in that cooperative effort?
We have a wide range there. From Roman Catholic, Lutheran, Presbyterian, Methodist, some churches out of the Free Church tradition, there's a Episcopalian, you know, a wide range there. I think because the 30-some churches now that are participating in that can agree upon the fact that part of the Christian witness needs to be carried out together. And
no single church could have
church could have done that.
What we have, just to make a matter of record, we have a site which was a church, was the site for the Bethesda Lutheran Church congregation at one time, and then became, I think, owned by a Baptist congregation, which then eventually sold, I believe, the structure to the Churches United. Has thus become a home for up to about 60, something like that.
Well, officially they are limited to a certain number, but unofficially and for historical accuracy, during inclement weather or at certain times of the season, exceed the official numbers.
And certainly their evening meals sometimes feed well beyond the capacity for overnight. But anyway, that's a clear evidence of some cooperative effort there that I think is very heartening.
And I think that one of the things that really was instructive for me was that the I had perceived of the community as a whole being rather conservative politically, economically, rather distrustful of homeless people or people who didn't fit into the norm.
Mm-hmm.
And that they would be reluctant as churches or as member of churches to be involved with this sort of thing. And yet, as I saw what happened in our church at First Church and in the other churches, it was apparent that politics and fiscal responsibility had little to do with their consideration. That it was basically, this is truly a need we have in the community. It is not important for us to pass judgment on these people. Our concern is, how can we meet the need?
Mm-hmm.
And this cut across all of those boundaries in the congregation of liberal, conservative, of socially active, socially inactive. As a matter of fact, one of the members came up to me when we were in the midst of a fund drive to help support Churches United and said, well, I don't believe with this, but since the church is doing, I guess I'll contribute to it.
Mm-hmm.
Which
mm-hmm.
was probably the greatest statement of faith I'd heard that day.
Sure.
But I saw this across the board with the other churches as well. It didn't matter if they were theologically liberal or conservative. What mattered was, this is a need.
Mm-hmm.
And we can work together to meet it.
As I look at this community, one need that I think is emerging, and I just had a conversation with a member of our church, Lee Krasonic, who is next year going to be the person in charge of the Migrant Workers Council.
Mm-hmm.
And we have had a substantial influx of people whose backgrounds are quite considerably different from the backgrounds of the majority of the population here. And considerably disadvantaged mm-hmm. in many respects. Community acceptance is limited in certain areas. That may well be an area where the church will have to see what it can mm-hmm. do as far as ameliorating the situation. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that the community itself has really taken the kind of actions that ultimately will be necessary in order mm-hmm. to relieve the tensions mm-hmm. that have emerged.
It struck me in Minneapolis, it was such a large community that it was easy for these groups to come in and be absorbed, these ethnic groups,
mm-hmm.
without anyone really noticing. But up here, it's a lot different.
Mm-hmm. It has been a relatively homogeneous mm-hmm. Upper European, Northern European yeah. kind mm-hmm. of background, and all of a sudden now we have people who speak different languages and have different backgrounds and
a different ethos
yeah.
entirely. I think that one of my impressions from early on, and one that the church never has felt comfortable in addressing, is the fact that initially, the Hispanic Americans or the Hispanic peoples who came in as migrant laborers to simply work the fields mm-hmm. in the summer and fall, and then were gone, and were seen of as just being common laborers,
mm-hmm.
People who were employed at whatever the going rate was. For whom minimal services were provided, and then they left. But now, with the changes in the economic realities of the world, are finding these people are finding, and I think we are finding, that if they want to survive, that places like the Red River Valley are going to be very attractive.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what we have to come to grips with is that the people who were migrant workers, Hispanics, who are moving into the area, are coming in for basically the same reasons that the Norwegians came in, that the Swedes came in, that my ancestors from England and Germany and Switzerland came in. They're coming in for the same reasons of stability of life, stability of their family, and for the economic benefits and social benefits. And how are we going to address that? I think we in the church, we in the community, we in the nation tend to have very short memories.
Oh, yeah.
And we don't realize that the hardship that our forebears went through in the old country and what they saw to be the benefits of moving to an entirely new land where they may not speak the same language.
Mm-hmm.
And that if America is to maintain its integrity as a nation, then I think we have to be willing to accept each new wave of immigrants, seeing in them not only a people who are striving for a better life and advantage, but also as contributors to our community.
Right.
If I were to walk into the Sons of Norway this afternoon and yell out that Norwegians are a bunch of worthless bums, I would justifiably be beaten up and thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's quite apparent that the Norwegian immigrants came over and contributed greatly to this nation. And I think that that's the same thing that we are beginning to experience with Southeast Asians across the country and Hispanics. But I think the churches need to really be at the forefront of this concern,
mm-hmm.
because it is first and foremost a concern that relates to human beings and the integrity of the individual as a child of God.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've covered quite a lot. And usually when I come to the close of one of these interviews, I always ask the interviewee or give the interviewee a last shot. Are there things that we should have covered that you'd like to review? Are there statements that you would like to make to get make a matter of record on this tape? I'll say the last item on the agenda is open, and if you have anything you want to add, here's your chance.
Oh, heavens, after talking this long, I can't think of anything more that I wanted to say.
Okay.
So I think we'll just leave it at that, and I will stand by the recorded record.
Very good. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.